Hi, it's Greg Kelly, and I am doing pretty well on my diet and exercise. A couple of starts and stops, but here's what's in my head. In 100 days, you can really transform your body. And that means one day is 1% of 100, right? Yeah, sure. Every morning, that's a half percent. A half percent is like significant. You know, that's a significant. If you wanted to save $1 million, what's 1% of a million? $10,000, right? That's not small, right? If you had to save, if you got $10,000 a day, every day, you'd have $1 million in 100 days. Anyway, $5,000 a morning. That's big money, all right? So every day, every moment, I feel like I'm making major progress toward my goal. And that's helped me a lot, all right? So I do really want to. I'm in okay shape, you know, but I could be a lot better. And why the hell not, you know? Why not? There's so much junk around and so many silly things to do other than exercise. And I mean, why not? Why not live it to the fullest, this life we have, right? And I owe it to myself and my little girl. Oh, I had a little health scare the other day. Everything's fine, but I had this weird cramp in my chest. So I want to make sure everything is great going forward. Everything is okay, but I've got to keep an eye on it. All right. So today, boy, talk about a guy who's worthy of emulation. He's taken care of his health. He's taken care of his financial health. He lives a fantastic life. He is 93 years old. His name is Hal Weiser. I first became acquainted with him through my friend Oscar. Hal was a naval aviator in his 20s, and he flew in the Korean War after graduating from the University of Georgia. After military service, he gets an entry-level management trainee job at Macy's, and they put him in the toy department. And the rest is history. He goes from there. He becomes the buyer. He becomes very successful. And then he goes on to play school. And then he starts his own company in Japan. And ultimately, I didn't ask him specifically about his finances. That's not very nice. But I could tell, and you'll be able to tell, the guy did extremely well and was able to retire at the age of 56. And doesn't seem to regret one day of his life. He's just a very cool guy. And I'm looking forward to you hearing from him. In the meantime, though, first, I would like to tell you about something I am extremely happy to be drinking. It's called D Espresso Liber Coffee. And, you know, they have a little slogan over there, freedom doesn't brew itself. It was founded by a Green Beret almost a decade ago, this D Espresso Liber company. It is amazing coffee. This it's 100% Arabica coffee. If you know your coffee, that's really great stuff. Sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world, it is roasted fresh in-house once they receive your order. The D'Espresso Liber experience starts from the moment you open the package. The aroma is so good, really as good as tasting this stuff. I could smell the coffee, actually, through the packaging even before I opened the bag. I am not exactly a coffee expert, but I can tell you that D'Espresso Liber coffee is really amazing stuff. It is very tasty, full-bodied, it's smooth, and it gives me a very delicious jumpstart to my day. It is rich in flavor and American values. D'Espresso Liber coffee encourages all of us to sit down together and unite with fellow patriots to celebrate our God-given rights. So, if you want to wake up every morning to a savory, micro-roasted cup of coffee that supports quality coffee farmers, America's special operations community, that's important, and our great country, visit D'Espresso Liber. That's D'Espresso Liber. D-E, Espresso, E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O, Liber, L-I-B-E-R.com. D'EspressoLiber.com. The only thing that's a little bit tricky, D'EspressoLiber, short for freedom, L-I-B-E-R.com. It's veteran-owned. It's a family-run small business whose brew tastes as good as it will make you feel. After all, freedom does not brew itself, okay? So let's support them. They are great people with a great product. In the meantime, my conversation with all-round super great fellow Hal Weezer made it big in business right after making it big in the military, serving his country as an F-4 Corsair pilot during the Korean War. So, sir, thank you very, very much. Listen, where are you?
No problem.
Where are you right now?
West Palm Beach, Florida.
How long have you been there?
20 years. I built a house here 20 years ago. But I've lived in many, many places. We just decided this is it. We had, for a long time, we had three places we had. So we've lived in many places, but this is it. This is where I'm going to, you know, finish up. That's it.
What is it? What is it about that place? Why West Palm? What do you like about it?
Well, first of all, this is Breakers West, so we're part of the Breakers Hotel System, and it's a very relatively small community. Excuse me. It's well guarded, well gated. In fact, our security people carry arms, so it's very safe. And you know, I have to tell you about the weather. The weather's great. And I just, you know, I'm from Savannah, Georgia, so I'm used to this type of weather, so I like it.
And forgive me, but how old are you?
93. I'll be 94 next month.
And how are you feeling? You sound terrific.
Well, I not only feel great, Greg, I take no medication at all. Now, I know that this is finite. I know nobody walks away from this. But right now, nothing's wrong. I don't wear glasses. I don't have a hearing aid. I don't have any arthritis. I don't take any pills, and I am very grateful.
First of all, are you opposed to medication? I mean, you've taken it throughout at times in your life, right?
No, I do whatever the doctor says. 20-something years ago, the doctor in a normal physical said to me, you don't need to take any. You don't even need to take a baby aspirin. There's nothing wrong with your heart or cholesterol, so forget it. Don't take anything. So I haven't taken anything.
Were you very careful about your health along the way? No?
No, I don't watch it. I know it sounds ridiculous. My mother is good genes. My mother lived to 97, very healthy, and I try to hold my weight, which is a lifelong job, as everybody knows. So I'm 6'4". I weigh about 225. When I went into the Navy, I was 6'4", and I weighed 222, so it's relatively the same.
Wow.
Wait a minute. It looks different, though.
Well, still.
You know, when you're 22 years old, it's a little bit of a different formation. But anyhow,
can I ask
you
this?
I feel good. I'm grateful for feeling good. I've been married 50 years. I'm married to a Swedish girl, and we're very happy. And I'm lucky, that's all, just pure luck.
Do you think—
I believe in luck.
You believe in luck?
I do. I do believe in luck. I believe in a lot of things a lot of guys don't believe in these days, but I do. I believe in God. I think I mentioned to you earlier, I'm Jewish, but I was educated in parochial and Catholic military school. And I didn't know at the time, but it was a very good base of an education.
Do you think about death at all? Like at your age?
Yes.
You know, you do.
Yes. But not in where I'm going as much as what I'm leaving. I find it just about impossible to get your arms around not existing. Very, very difficult. And I don't know what you studied in school, but I got into St. Thomas Aquinas when I was very young. And some of his writings, Thomistic writings, he goes into great length about the way people can accept the universe, the galaxies, the billions of universes, and never see them or can't prove them. And they have trouble accepting a supreme being, although you can't see or touch that either. So, I don't know, maybe you in the Navy, and I never met a guy that got in trouble that didn't turn to God, because there was nowhere else to turn. Now, I'm not a religious person, let me up front. I don't go to church, I don't go to synagogue. I guess I like traditional stuff, the traditions and the things, but I'm not an organized religious person. I just believe. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Sure it does. Sure. Of course.
Anyhow, I grew up in Savannah. My mother and father from Savannah. Both sets of my grandparents were born in Savannah. So we've been there a long time.
What's your birthday?
Well, this is going to be interesting, I think. I'm technically just about 24 years old. I'm born on leap year. Now, I look pretty good for 93. I don't look so good for 23. You know?
And that's funny. Look, does it say, by the way, does it say February 29th on your driver's license and everything like that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. What did your parents do?
My father was in the jewelry business, retail. However, one of the little prize things I have is I have a picture. I'm sitting in my den talking to you now, and I'm staring at the bookcase across, and on it is a picture of my father in World War I in the Navy in France. And I have that picture. So it's kind of a prize picture for me.
What can you describe it to us? And what and
he's in Marseille with I think it's about six or seven sailors, and he's sitting down with them, and they're in France and during World War One, around 1917, I would think.
So he was in the jewelry business, and did you have brothers and sisters?
I had two sisters, both of whom have passed away. Everybody in my family for several generations are buried at a place called Bonaventure Cemetery. I don't know if you ever read the book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Oh, sure. Well, a long time ago, yeah.
That's about Bonaventure Cemetery. That's what it's about. So the whole family's there. In fact, there are two plots, one for me and one for my wife, but I'm going to be buried in the military cemetery here in West Palm Beach.
And I'm sorry, but is your wife is alive?
Yeah, she's Swedish, and she's 17 years younger than I.
All right, so back to growing up in Savannah with your two sisters and your mom and dad. What did you like to do? What was your best subject in school? And just tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up there.
Well, I grew up in a very conservative, pro-military home. My parents were very conservative, very Southern. If you ask my parents or any parents that I knew of then, what are you? They would always say we're Southern. It dominated their thinking about themselves. They were Southern. And this Catholic school, ironically, my father, I was a legacy. My father went there before I did. So there's a small group, maybe not so small, maybe 100 families, Jewish families in Savannah that have been there since the early 1800s. Just about 100% German heritage, German-Austrian heritage, very conservative. And that's where I grew up. I grew up in a way I wish America was today. Just a terrific childhood. I mean, America was wonderful. I remember as a kid, I was 12 years old when World War II was going on, and I remember if I was in the movie house and they played the Star Spangled Banner, everyone in the movie house stood up. We all stood up. And I liked it. I'm still very patriotic. I'm still very pro-military, and it's the way I grew up, and it's the way I remained, and it's the way I am now.
What people are talking about these days right now, and it does come to mind immediately for me, you grew up Jewish in the South. Now, from the outside looking in, or from what I've been told, that was, tricky.
No. You've got it. In my experience, and in any guy I knew from Savannah, Georgia, you have it 180 degrees out. There was no anti-Semitism. Where I grew up was terrific. We had the same kind of interesting, the same way there was a cadre of Jewish families that had been there like forever. There was the same amount of Greek families there, and in fact, the mayor of Savannah was Greek for many, many years. Now, I was 6'4 and 220, so I didn't get picked on, so to speak. But I honestly was never conscious or aware of any anti-Semitism when I grew up.
Excellent.
Now, there may have been hick towns, and small places and ignorance, which is always around, but not where I grew up. I never had that problem, and certainly not in the school I went to. I was taught by Benedictine monks, not Jesuits, but the second teaching order is Benedictines. And I never witnessed anti-Semitism growing up.
Now, with that, you are Jewish, you're going to Christian schools. Was there a push to make you convert? Was there a push to say,
No. In fact, there were three other Jewish boys in this school, all legacies. Their parents, their fathers had gone there before them. So there were four of us, totally accepted, integrated completely. The Jewish community was totally integrated in Savannah. They've been there forever. And even there's a book, Jews of Savannah, and another one, Jews in the Civil War. They were just, you're going back to the early, if not the beginning of the 1800s. So there was never any feeling of visiting. They belong there, and that's the way they felt. And the people there felt the same. So I don't know, I know you read about growing up a minority in the South and that type, but I didn't witness any of that. I was very comfortable with growing up.
What was your, I take it you were an athlete in school?
Somewhat, not great. I was a good basketball player. I actually did more in the Navy. When I went down to Pensacola, I played on the basketball team, and I also boxed. But I only did that to get out of organized calisthenics, So.
Well, before the Pensacola trip, just tell me a little bit about high school and college. First of all, what was your favorite subject? What did you excel in?
What did I excel in? Well, I don't know if I had a favorite subject. I think looking back on your life and saying, if I could do it again, what would I do? I have things I would do differently. But I think when I was growing up, I don't know, I graduated this school, Benedictine Military Academy, and went off to the University of Georgia. World War II was over when I graduated this military school in 1946. World War II was over. I went to the University of Georgia. I studied marketing in the business administration. I got a degree in June of 1950, and North Korea invaded South Korea at the same time. I went up to Naval Air Station in Atlanta, enlisted, went down to Pensacola. But I was already, I would say, a competent pilot at that time.
Oh, wait, a couple of things. When you went through University of Georgia, were you able to pay for it yourself? Do you remember what the tuition was back then?
No, I didn't follow the question.
I'm sorry. Did you pay for your own schooling at Georgia? Was it expensive?
No, it was not expensive. I doubt if it cost more than a couple of $1,000 a year.
It's incredible what has
in
happened.
In state. I mean, we were state residents, of course. But going back, just what might interest you here, is one day when I was in military school, a captain in the Army Air Corps. There was no Army Air Force, Greg. It was the Army Air Corps. There was no Air Force. Did you know that?
Yes, I did, actually.
Okay. There was no Marine Corps. They were part of the Navy in those days. But anyhow, this captain came to the school and spoke to us because they wanted to, this was in the midst of the war, World War II, and they wanted to clear a field outside of Savannah so they could teach new pilots. And they would bus us out there after school if we would help clear these fields. And they would pay us in flight lessons. And I got a solo license and a Piper Cub when I was 16 years old. So I got hooked on flying at a very early age. And like all those kids at my age, we were building model airplanes all the time, you know, and that's what we did. Then I went off to the University of Georgia. And when the war was over, the War Department sold surplus aircraft to pilots if they wanted them. The war was over. And some guy, a fighter pilot from World War II, purchased an SNJ. You're familiar with that aircraft?
I'm going to look it up right now, but not off the top of my
head. You probably trained in it.
I don't know. I was in a Beechcraft T-34 FNJ plane.
SNJ.
SNJ. All right.
Sam. SNJ.
And there it is. It's a little bit different. This is a tail dragger.
Oh, okay.
And mine was not, but I'm looking at it. It's similar to the T-34.
We would tail dragger. We didn't have tripod. Well, anyhow, so he bought one. And every spare dollar I had, I would go after classes. This is the university. And take lessons from him. And I did that for 4 years. And I had a couple hundred hours in that plane.
Wow.
And when I went down to Pensacola, I saw what they were teaching. They didn't have to teach me. I mean, I got into some accelerated program. In fact, they made me the regimental subcommand at the prefect school. But they started on me with some formation flying. I had to learn, obviously, carrier on the field carrier stuff and gunnery and stuff that I didn't know anything about. But as far as flying the plane, I didn't have to learn how to fly the plane. So
what a way to go through flight school. I love it.
It didn't take me that long. But because it was like you drive a car and they teach you how to parallel park. That's
right.
What it was.
Let me ask you, did you go in as an ensign or did you go in as an enlisted person? You said you enlisted. What rank were you?
No, I went in as a NAVCAD.
A NAVCAD, sure.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting. I doubt if it exists today. But when I went in, besides passing whatever physical and mental tests you had to pass, they had two caveats. One, you had to have a college degree. And two, you could not be married. You had to be single. I don't know if that exists today.
To become an officer, you can be married. Generally speaking, you have to have a college degree.
Yeah.
There are some exceptions. The NAVCAD program did exist when I was going through. They were very interesting. That was an interesting program. It was different. You didn't have to be a college graduate to be a NAVCAD.
Well, you did in my day.
Yeah, I think they have obviously.
You had to have a college degree in my day to be to be in the NAVCAD program.
And you would be commissioned though at the end of it or not? What would you be?
Yeah. You're commissioned before the end of it.
Okay.
You got commissioned right before you got your wings.
And where were you doing? This is all Pensacola, but where in Pensacola? It's a pretty broad.
Well, there were three fields. I don't know why at this age I still remember. It was Corey, Whiting, and Softly. Those three fields are where you trained.
Yeah.
And then I went to Corpus and then down to Brownsville.
Where were you living? Where were you living in Pensacola?
In the BOQ.
On the main NAS Naval Air Station, Pensacola.
Yeah, on the main base, yeah.
I've landed at all those fields, by the way. Well, Softly and Whiting. I don't remember Corey, but I certainly remember the others. And are you having the time of your life learning how to fly? I mean, learning the advanced flying and the gunnery. Are you enjoying it?
every second of it. I loved it. I loved every minute of it. In fact, I faced a dilemma. I was about halfway through my tour, and a skipper called me in one day, and he had a bulletin or something from the Navy Department. I was USNR, right? Mm-hmm. And this bulletin had some qualifications that if these USNR pilots met those qualifications, they could be automatically USN. So he said to me, you beat those qualifications and you can go U.S. Navy now. I said, no. He said, think about it. You had 4 years of ROTC at the University of Georgia, which count. I didn't know. And now you have 4 years of active service, 12 years. When you get out, you're going to be 26 years old. If you stay to 38, you're in full pension. 12 more years, you're in full pension. But I didn't stay. I had one problem with the service, not the love of the service, but the only problem I had with it was the requirement for time and rank to be advanced. It just didn't sit well with me that if you're sitting as a lieutenant, you got 5 years, you got to sit there to be a lieutenant commander. You got to spend 5 years, no matter what you do, you know?
Yeah. No matter how good you are, no matter how bad you are.
Yeah. Not. You had, until you got into command status, you had to serve time and rank, and I just didn't do it. But I'm long-winded to answer to your question. I loved the military. I loved while I was in the military. I loved everything about it, and I still respect it and support it, and I support the Navy SEALs. I support all those charities because I believe in it.
Now, when were you winged? When did you actually get your... were you winged early because of your experience?
Yeah,
you were?
Yeah. Okay. I was winged in 1950.
And what did they do? What was your first assignment, your first fleet assignment, when you were done with all of the kind of training or the... For you,
Korea.
Was it Korea. You went to Korea.
Yeah.
And you were carrier-based.
On the Boxer.
And the plane that you flew was the...
F4U.
And the F-4U, was that also, that was used in World War II as well?
Yes, it was.
Now,
it was the predominant, well, it was the fastest fighter. The plane that was the most successful in the Navy in World War II was the F-6, the Hellcat. I think the kill ratio of that plane was way above every other aircraft made by Grumman. I don't think Grumman exists today. But they made the F-6, the F-8, and the F-6 was the best, or I should say the most successful fighter aircraft the Navy had. When the Corsair came out, it was a problem because it's a gigantic nose, and you can't hardly see over it. And they rejected it for the carrier for a long time. And then they produced a drop-nose version where you could see a little bit, and... So initially, but later on, it became, you know, iconic, and a lot because of its beauty. It's just a beautiful airplane, and the Corsair in the Navy and the P-51 Mustang in the Air Force, those were the two iconic aircraft.
Gosh, you're right about the nose. It is tremendous.
Well, there's a 2,000 horsepower Pratt Whitney engine on that thing, and...
Now, wait, you know, but weren't jets coming online, and did you have any desire?
No, you know when jets came? No, the jets didn't come to the Navy that fast. The Air Force, they were getting beat up pretty good by the MiG-15s at that time. And the Air Force developed the F-84 Star Jet or something like that. That was the Air Force plane, and they actually got to the point that they dominated. They took over. And they were very good, but not the Navy. The Navy's main mission, from the middle on in Korea, was air ground support. They had the ground support for those Marines stuck up in Chosun Reservoir and the Yalu River area. A lot of air to ground support because the Air Force kind of took control of the skies, and it wasn't much of a problem.
Now, Can you, you went on the Boxer and you're going over there. What was it? These were combat missions you were flying.
Well, every mission in a sense was a combat mission, Greg. Just taking off and doing a sortie or something, coming back. It was more, you're worrying more truthfully about your heavy loaded takeoffs and then landings than grabbing the wire than you did about air combat at that time. It's just the flying itself. And in fact, when I got out, when I made a decision to get out, I didn't know what I was going to do. I got offers. We all got offers from commercial flight aircraft, plane companies to come to them because obviously the military had spent so much money on us that we were good subjects for commercial pilots, but I didn't want to do that. So I got out and honestly, I had no idea what to do. And I went to New York and I got on Macy's, the department store Macy's training squad, a very prestigious assignment. Every young guy wanted it. Every young girl wanted it. And you got paid $125 every 2 weeks. So it wasn't a money thing, but it was a training thing. And to show you how chancy and haphazard life can be, I was assigned early on to the toy department. And I became the toy buyer. And the rest of my working life was in the toy industry. And without question, had Macy's put me in the shoe department, I would have been in the shoe business because I had no direction. It was retailing. I didn't know anything. And it made me realize that if you're going to succeed, you'll succeed in just about anything you go into. I believe that a guy that rises up and becomes a CEO of a major corporation is the same guy that'll become an admiral if he stayed in the Navy or go into any business.
Can I just ask you this first? Why took a hard line? You did not want to fly in the airlines, and you were a pilot. You love flying. Why didn't you want to go into the airlines?
I think I was through flying.
Did you have any near misses?
By the way, I never flew again when I got out. And that's not unusual, Greg. I know many guys like that. I never flew again.
And is there a reason for that? I know you're right. There are guys like that. But why?
I think I just had done it. I don't know if I had to. I never tried to put a reason on it. I just knew that I was done with it. And I had done it, and I was proud of what I did. And, I was over with it. It was over. I also maybe the fact that that's an expensive hobby and I couldn't afford that had something to do with it. It's one thing to fly in the military. It's another thing to go out. You don't have any money. You're starting out in life. You can't afford to lease aircraft or rent a plane. And also, you're a pilot. Do you want to rent a plane and fly after what you did? Do you want to just go up and fly point A to point B and back? You'd be bored with that.
Yeah, it does seem a little anticlimactic. So, New York, you're in that training program.
I'm in the training program. They put me in the toy department. I become the toy buyer.
And that means you're buying toys for stores, for Macy's all over the place
Wait,
before we get there, where were you living in New York?
I was living in those days, actually in New Jersey. I had an apartment in New Jersey and I was commuting on the Lackawanna Railroad into New York to go to work.
And is this a competitive program? Is it intense? What's it like, this training program?
It's not competitive at all. It's a group of young people, all college graduates, different colleges, mostly Ivy League. And you go into the program, and you work in just about every single department within the store. You know, even the backroom stuff, the accountings, the receivables, the shipping, all these things, they just teach it all to you. Then comes Christmas time, and everyone's assigned to a department. And I was assigned to the toy department, and then I liked it, so I became an assistant, then I became the buyer. And I worked at Macy's as a buyer, and one day a company called Play School, I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Sure, yep.
Came and offered me a job, and I went to work for Play School, and I became executive vice president of Play School. And I went from making maybe $5,000 a year to $12,000 a year, and I was very happy with that. And I worked there 7 years, at which time I traveled to Japan several times for them, you know, on buying trips to Japan. I got totally enamored with Japan. I quit Play School, started my own business in Japan, and that's how I built my business, from Japan.
All right, wait, before we get to that, if you don't mind, you're buying toys. And
yeah.
Some people have seen the movie Big, Tom Hanks,
yeah.
And there's a toy buyer. He's a toy buyer. And how do you, so you're the guy, you're picking toys. Okay, we think this will sell well Christmas time.
Yeah.
That's what you're in charge of doing. How did you,
and
you were pretty good at it. How did you, what do you base that on? I mean, that's not necessarily something they can teach.
Well, a lot of it's based on current events. I mean, when I was a toy buyer there, Russia launched the Mir space ball, the first one ever. And of course, space went crazy and all space toys were selling. Davy Crockett on TV was red hot. So you got Davy Crockett merchandise. The hula hoop was a big fad. So you start buying hula hoops. I mean, it's not some genius sitting in a tower making a selection. It's kind of what's going on. You know what I mean?
Sure. And what happened in Japan? Like, you're enamored with Japan. What intrigued you so much about Japan? And what?
The culture, Greg. I'm from Savannah. I was so enamored with that culture. It was so different than anything I ever saw or knew. And I just got into it. And I traveled every single inch of that country over the years. I just got to know it, and I liked it. And also, in those days, I could start a business, in Japan without any money. I didn't have any money. So I was able to do it. In fact, my first toy that I produced myself was the James Bond Aston Martin car from the James Bond movie. And I produced it in Japan, and that was the first toy I had.
So a couple of things. Number one, well, on that Aston Martin James Bond car, at this stage, I mean, do you have to get permission from the movie company?
Yeah, you have to pay a license for it.
You did. Okay, you did all that.
Yeah.
And, all right, what was the name of the company you established?
It was a holding company named Durham, D-U-R-H-A-M, and we bought other things. In fact, at the end of it, we bought Ideal Toy, which was a big toy company. But, you know, we did a lot of licensing, Greg. If I don't know, anything you could think of that was on the movies or television and red hot, we would license it. We would pay a licensing fee to produce products.
Was this company established in Japan, or was it in America, or what? Like, I know you.
Well, it wound up everywhere. It started in Japan, but then we had offices in Hong Kong. We had a place in Yugoslavia. I mean, we in America we had manufactured big things, dollhouses and stuff, because you know when you ship out of the Orient, and they talk about a ton of something, they're talking about 40 square feet. They're not talking about weight. So any bulky thing had to be produced in the States, and small stuff in the Orient, really.
Now, was this are you living in Japan during this time?
No, but I'm spending probably half my time there, back and forth.
Did you learn Japanese?
Yes.
You speak Japanese?
Yes.
That's very cool. I don't know. You get to a country, you like it, you say, I'm going to leave this, I'm going to start a new business. And you had the idea that the business that you want to create, Japan was somehow more hospitable?
I didn't grow up wanting to be in the toy business. And as far as business was concerned, to me, it was a means to an end. I was very active in a thing called YPO. Are you familiar with that?
Young Presidents Organization?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And in the New York, Long Island, I was chairman of that, in that area. And one day, a very prominent member committed suicide. Mm. And YPO includes wives and everything. So my wife and I and several other people went. His widow invited us to talk to his psychiatrist, the guy that killed himself. And they gave the reasons why he did it. He explained that there were three pressures on us. We were all, you got to be under 40 to join, and you're all entrepreneurs. And he said there are three pressures. There's the pressure of personal health, there's the pressure of personal relationship, and then there's business. And you can be bad in any two if the third is good. But if all three are bad, you're going to jump out of the window or something. Well, I remember trying to figure out how to avoid that. And I believe everybody has a number. It's all different. I knew there was a number that if I could get to that number, then I could live the lifestyle I want to live. Not yachts and airplanes, but just the lifestyle I wanted. And I really decided if I can get to that number, I'm going to quit. And I did. I was 56 years old. I've been retired, 37 years. I got to that number, and I walked away.
All right. Do me a favor. A couple of things, though, first. How did you meet your wife? Where was she?
She was a Pan Am stewardess in New York.
And you met her on a flight to Japan?
No, mutual friends. She's my second wife. I was married. My first wife has passed away. I was married 20 years. And I've been married to this lady close to 50 years.
Forgive me, but how did your first wife die?
Cancer.
And did you have children with her?
I have three sons. They all live in L.A. Yes.
Now, when you're...
I have three sons, five grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren.
So, this man who... And first of all, where were you living when you're active with the YPOs? You mentioned New York, New Jersey. You had the apartment at this point.
I was living in Great Neck, New York.
Do you remember the address?
Huh, that's funny. It was Great Neck Estates. I don't recall.
Did you commute?
My kids probably do. I don't remember.
You commuted into the city?
Yes.
Where was your office?
I commuted on the Long Island Railroad in the city, and I didn't like it, but I did.
Where was your office?
At 205th Avenue, where the toy building is called the toy building.
205th Avenue, the toy building. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the man who killed himself, how old was he?
Well, he had to be between 40 and 50 because at the age of 50, you must leave YPO. You have to qualify before your 40th birthday. And if you become a member, you have to leave on your 50th birthday. That's where the young comes in.
In the three categories, personal relationships, personal health, and your business, you can manage as long as you're doing well in one of them. That's very interesting.
Survive. Yeah. You can handle it. You can handle it.
That's fascinating.
But if all three go south, you can't handle it.
Do you remember him personally? Did you know him?
A little bit. His name was Black. He was the guy that was involved in the Banana Republic scandal. United Fruit, United Brands, or whatever it was.
Oh, wait a second. Is this the guy who jumped out of the Pan Am building?
He jumped out of, I think it was the UN building, UN Plaza.
He was the head of...
He may have been Pan Am, but he jumped out of the window.
He was the head of Chiquita Banana?
No, he's head of United Brands or United Fruit. It was they called it the Banana Republic. It was a big scandal. This company, had corrupted the government itself. I don't remember the details.
No, I actually kind of remember the story, strangely enough, and it was Eli Black was his name.
Yes.
Yeah. Goodness gracious. Yes. It was the Pan Am building, by the way. I'm looking at it right now, 44th floor, 1975. So, all right, you get this number in your head. How old are you in 1975? I could do the math myself, but you're...
Well, I was probably 60, something like that.
And did you think that... no, you're a bit younger. Than, like, and you had this number in your head. First of all, you make...
A financial number. How much money would we need to live just a nice life that we lead? And when I got to that number, I walked away. And it's not so easy to walk away because at that point, it was pretty easy for me in business. But I just felt, I don't want to sound like some wise old guy because I'm not, but I knew that, and maybe I heard it somewhere, is that if you have what you need, if you give up any quality of life to get more than that, it's a bad bargain. So I was more concerned with the quality of my life than making more than I needed. I got nothing against a guy having more than he needs. It's just that I wasn't going to give up any quality of my life to get more than I needed.
Did you feel...
And that was the way I... Sounds like I'm some philosopher. I'm not.
Oh.
It's just the way I felt.
Did you ever feel, though, did you ever regret it? Did you ever, was that, what was that transition like, going from being this high-level executive, traveling the world to, you know, retiring? I mean, what was, and...
Easiest pie. I never missed it at all. And we continued to travel. I mean, we had a home in St. Moritz where we used to go to ski. We had a home up in Connecticut. We were in New York City. We had a home in Colorado.
Oh my God!
So we were traveling all the time, and as far as work goes, I didn't miss it because I didn't grow up wanting to do this. I just found I wanted to make a living, and that's the way it turned out. But I didn't have any love of the business I was in. It was just a business.
Well, okay, but a couple of quick things. You were obviously good at it. You obviously had great work ethic. Like, what were some of the things that made you successful? You achieved a lot. You succeeded at a high level. I understand it wasn't necessarily your passion or whatever. You were just kind of, you know, you wanted to make a living, but you were very good at it. What do you attribute that to? Did you have any...
You know, that's an interesting question. I think if I attribute anything to my military or my business life, it would be the discipline I got accustomed to in the school I went to, the military school. I became very disciplined, and I think I maintained that all my life.
What does that mean in a practical sense? Like getting up at the same time every day? You know, like I understand what discipline is,
I think it means... I don't leave anything unfinished. I think I'm tidy. I think I had a priest once say to me, you want to be successful, do something you don't like each day. And I think if you got a job, you do it. And no matter what it is, you're conscientious about it. You take the responsibility, you do it. And I think that's a discipline. I don't think... I'm on time. I don't know what that means, but I'm very much on time wherever I go. And I'm very intolerant of people who are always late. I think it's rude. So all those things are a discipline. And I think I got very organized and very disciplined very early in my life. And that was it. And that it stayed with me.
What was your highest title? What was your, when you retired, what were you? What would it say on your business card?
CEO.
CEO of Durham Holdings, or what was the name?
Yes, Durham Industries, yes.
Durham Industries. And I just have a couple of quick questions on this. The people, how big, how many people worked for you?
Probably close to 100.
And
because we had people overseas working for us as well.
Can I just ask you this about the people who are working for you? Who are the ones who This is what my dad says. He's hired a lot of people. He said, when you hire somebody, you know, you really never know what you're getting. You don't really know what they're like until they start working for you. And some people surprise you and some people disappoint you. Yeah. Anyway, what were some of the things you noticed about employees? I guess somebody starting out in the business world, like what are some things?
Well, it's a funny thing. I found that guys and ladies who went to, let's say, a Midwestern college, outperformed most of the Ivy League people we had. I think they worked harder. But I think if I had to pick one quality that was very important to me, it was follow-through. When I got hold of somebody who, if you gave them an assignment, you could just walk away and never think back on it because you knew they were going to take care of it. That became very important. People who follow through, and that's a discipline itself. That was an important factor for me.
Now, when you leave, you don't miss it. You've got homes around the world, and you're traveling. Can I ask you this though? What about structure to your day? What did you did you design each day in a certain way when you don't have a job?
I think I was born to be retired. I think it was the easiest thing in the world for me. I like to read, and I don't know. I know it sounds kind of childish, but I don't have any trouble with this. I never did. I've been offered within the first few years of my leaving the company, I got offered very big jobs, but I didn't retire from my company to go to work for someone else. I wasn't interested. So I just want to tell you that it's just an individual thing, because I have many friends who retire and they can't stay retired. They get bored and they miss it and they get back into it. I never did. I didn't miss it at all. And it was easy for me.
Again, this is a remarkable American life. Can I just ask you this about politics? By the way, have you ever crossed paths with Trump? You don't live too far from him.
Yes, I have.
When did you first meet him?
Oh, years ago at a party in Mar-a-Lago. No. You know when I first met him? We had an apartment at 530 Park Avenue. That's the corner of 61st and Park. Very close friends with Dee Dee's first husband. Dee Dee and her first husband lived next door to us at 530 Park Avenue. We were next door neighbors in the apartment house. And her first husband, Richard, was a consulate in Canada and got the visa that let Ivana Trump into America. And one night, and this is funny because I'm going back 50 years ago, one night Dee Dee invited Ivana and her husband Donald to dinner in her apartment. And we were there. The six of us had dinner together. So that's when I first met Donald Trump, in Dee Dee's apartment.
I love it. And what was he like?
Prick. Listen, I know a lot of guys here in Palm Beach. I mean, we go out a lot. I'm in a poker game with some guys. Every one of them is, you know, been involved with people like Donald Trump. And not one person has anything good to say about him. Not one. Now, I voted for him. If he runs against Biden, I'll vote for him again. But I wish he would pick up his cards and move on. He won't, but I wish he would. I wish he would move along. Because I think if anything could get screwed up, he may screw it up. My politics, I'm very conservative. I would certainly vote for Trump over any Democrat that I know of right now, whether or not somebody that comes along who's a Ronald Reagan type of person, that's a different story. I'm very conservative. So is my wife. So are my children, by the way, who live in L.A., and it's hard to be conservative out there, but they are.
Thank you, sir, for talking me through all this. I think, who do you like other than Trump? Who do you like right now in 2020? 2024?
In 2024? Very interesting question, Greg, because I might not be here 4 years from now.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I'm very loose about it. I'm joking. I'm not joking, but I'm not sensitive about it. I would like to see at this stage someone like DeSantis and maybe Tim Scott run together.
Hmm.
I also think this woman who's governor of South Dakota is a terrific candidate.
And do people come to you for endorsements, or I guess politicians have been knocking on your door for contributions for a long time?
Oh, sure, sure, sure. I mean, these are not major contributions, but and I don't contribute just because they are the same party I am. But if I like the candidate, see, unfortunately, I believe that a lot of voting these days is negative voting. In other words, I don't think 80 million people voted for Biden. I think a lot of people voted against Trump.
Oh,
I think it's anti-voting is what it is. And so here we got, if Biden runs again, I mean, they're talking about Hillary Clinton of all people. But if that's who's running and it's Trump against him, certainly I'd vote for Trump.
So what you know, as you look back and as you look forward, I think you said you have a hard time getting your hands around the idea of a lack of existence. You know something.
Yes.
You believe in
God. I mean,
God.
Can you visualize non-existence? I don't think it's possible.
I don't know, but like you, I believe in God. I personally believe in Jesus. I'm a Christian, but
right. I
I know that things. This is all preliminary, actually. Do you have any fear about that? Any fear about what's next?
No. I think I said I don't fear where I'm going. I regret when I'm leaving.
Right.
I have a good life. I love my life. I have gotten to the point that it's corny, but I'm literally smelling the roses. I'll tell you something else I'm doing, and I'll pass it on to you because I wish I knew to do this earlier. You know, when you wake up in the morning, Greg, when anyone does, when you wake up, if your leg hurts or your arm hurts, you're conscious of that, aren't you?
Sure.
When you wake up, if nothing hurts, do you focus on that?
No, right.
And I'm starting to focus on that. I know it sounds kind of corny, but I'm literally saying to myself some mornings, you know, Jesus, this is so good. I feel good. Nothing hurts. I'm so lucky. I'm starting to focus on it. And it's something I wish I knew how to do that years ago. Because we just take well-being for granted, and we shouldn't.
What a wonderful.
So I'm doing those things, and that's an age process, obviously. And I'm looking at it. I still play golf. Should I say I go on the golf course? I don't know if anybody would classify it as playing golf. But when I come back from golf, I go sit on the patio and I read or I look out, and it's just beautiful, just beautiful. And I'm saying to myself, man, that's pretty. So back to your question, I really will regret leaving all this. I have absolutely no fear of what's out there. And I do believe my soul will continue. And it will continue perhaps two generations. Because I believe after I die, any time a friend or a family member or anyone thinks of me or talks about me or reminisces, that's my soul. That is my soul. And obviously, after a couple of generations, there won't be anybody even know who I am. But that's what I believe. I believe your soul does survive. And again, I don't know about being judged later, by some supreme being. I don't know that I can buy that. But I do believe in God. I believe there's a meaning for life. It's not just so random and haphazard without any meaning. And I'm going to regret leaving this. I'm going to regret leaving Oscar, Dee Dee, my friends, my wife, my children, my life. I'm going to regret leaving it. I don't want to leave it. I really don't. But I'm not afraid of it.
Yeah.
I just regret it.
What a guy, huh? Really impressive. Hal Weiser. You know, I meant to ask him, what is Hal short for? Hal. Hal. Got to get back to you on that. Hal. There's Hal Holbrook. What was that short for? Hal. Sorry about this, but I got to figure it out. Hal. Hal. What? Anybody know what that is? No one can hear me right now. H-A-L. Name. The name Hal. Hal is a masculine given name, often a diminutive form of Harold or Henry or Harvey. Hal is a masculine given name. Okay, Hal. Harold or Henry. Okay, fair enough. Let's see, Hal Ashby, he was pretty famous. And no, that's just his middle name, Hal. William Hal Ashby. All right, anyway, I will get that clarified once I meet him, which should be next month. In the meantime, many thanks to our sponsor, D'Espresso Liberté Coffee. It was founded by a Green Beret about a decade ago. He developed a dedication to crafting outstanding brews after multiple deployments. D'Espresso Liberté Coffee, again, is 100% Arabica coffee sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world and is roasted fresh in-house once they receive your order. I like them very, very much. I highly recommend them. Great people, great coffee. And by the way, they do serve America's Special Operations Community, okay? They are America's Special Operations Community. They maintain great relations as well. So check out DeEspressoLaBear.com. DeEspressoLaBear.com. Now, that's DeEspressoLaBear.com. DeEspressoLaBear, LIBER.com. It helps if you capitalize the D, D-E, and then capitalize the espresso, E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O, LaBear, LIBER.com. Check it out. Veteran-owned, family-run, small business. Their brew tastes as good as it will make you feel, and as they say, freedom doesn't brew itself. So let's support them, and thank you for supporting this podcast. To be continued.